Hi guys, my name is Amaya and welcome to Never Too Much True Crime. I'm here with you every week with a new true crime case. And for this week's case, we're going to be talking about Daniel LaPlante. Daniel LaPlante was born on May 15th, 1970 in Townsend, Massachusetts. Growing up, he lived with his mother, Eileen, and his stepfather, David Moore. He had two brothers, Stephen and Matthew. His parents didn't really take good care of him either. On top of that, he struggled with dyslexia, so school was hard for him. Because of Daniel's weird behavior and horrible hygiene, it was hard for him to make friends, so he was a loner. His classmates would avoid him. His clothes were always dirty and he smelled pretty bad. During his teenage years, he would get evaluated by a psychiatrist, where he was diagnosed as having a hyperactive disorder. He was supposed to get treatment, but instead he would start being sexually abused by his own psychiatrist. This resulted in Daniel spiraling. Nothing disgusts me more than people who take advantage of others when they are in a vulnerable state. He already grew up in a harsh environment, so he probably felt very alone at that time and couldn't trust anyone. Everywhere he turned, someone was always doing something horrible to him. Not trying to justify his behavior that happens later on, but he didn't deserve to be treated like that as a kid. Daniel would start breaking into people's homes for fun. When he would do this, it would give him a rush. He would leave things around like half-drunk beverages to let people know that someone was in their home to scare them. He enjoyed seeing his victims being scared and paranoid. One of his victims being the Andrews family. The Andrews family lived in Pepperell, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Massachusetts. Brian Andrews, the father, lived with his two daughters, 15-year-old Annie and 8-year-old Jessica. His wife passed away from cancer, so it was a difficult time for the family. Brian would work a lot more to provide for his daughters, so he was rarely home, leaving Annie and Jessica at the house alone all the time. Annie and Jessica had a very close relationship. Annie, being 15, started thinking about boys. Her and her friends would talk about dating often. This is when Annie would receive phone calls from a boy. She was excited when the boy was telling her about himself. He told her that he's handsome, tall, blonde, smart, and athletic. We all know that's a lie. The person who was calling Annie was Daniel. Daniel was not tall. Or blonde. He snuck into the Andrews home doing some digging. That's where he found out that there were two daughters that lived there from the family photos. Seeing the photos of Annie made Daniel obsessed with her, finding out the family's phone number. He would continue calling her, asking her out on a date. He wanted to take her to the fair. She was excited and said yes. The day of the date, she gets ready. She hears the doorbell ring. She opens the door. She meets Daniel. He is not tall, he is not blonde or athletic, his face is covered with acne, he's very scrawny. She got catfished, okay? If I was there, I would be mad. Like, you catfished me. How you gonna lie and say that you're tall and handsome and blonde and you're not? And the crazy part is that she talked to Daniel over the phone for a whole week. So imagine talking to a boy for a whole week and you meet in person and he looks nothing like the way that he described himself. I know she was disappointed. They go to the fair, they start talking, getting to know each other. The date isn't going well. Annie was uncomfortable the whole time being around Daniel. She knew there was something off about him. She tells him about the death of her mother. She died from cancer. When Annie was telling him about the death of her mother, Daniel seemed too excited. His eyes started to sparkle, and he wanted Annie to talk more about her mom's death. He was asking tons of questions, just being very odd. This made Annie feel even more uncomfortable. The date ends up being short because she lets Daniel know that she doesn't want to see him or talk to him ever again. She made it very clear. Time passes. Annie and Jessica are home alone again, talking about their mom. They had an idea to do a seance. They didn't expect anything to happen. They went down to the basement during the seance. They lit candles, held hands, and sang some songs. They were having fun with it. They didn't take it very seriously. When their father, Brian, came home from work, they ended it. Annie and Jessica were lying in their beds late that night. That's when they started hearing tapping noises on the walls. They thought maybe the seance worked. They sat together in Annie's room listening to the tapping. They were excited that it worked, or so they thought it did. Their excitement didn't last too long. They would hear tapping noises more often. It only occurred when they were home alone or when their father was asleep. It started to get worse because the girls weren't getting any sleep. It was not long before objects and furniture began moving around the house and disappearing. One of the girls would put food out on the kitchen counter, leave the room for a couple of minutes, and when they came back, it would be gone. They told Brian, their father, about what was going on. They believed there was a ghost in the house. He didn't believe them and told them it was nonsense. They were just sad over the loss of their mother. One evening, they were home alone. They heard tapping noises again. It sounded like it was coming from downstairs. Annie grabbed a kitchen knife. They both went down to the basement. On the wall, there was a message written in what looked like blood. The writing on the wall said, "I'm in your room. Come and find me." They ran to their neighbor's house, who let them stay until their father returned from work. Brian comes home. He sees the writing on the wall. It was written with ketchup, actually, instead of blood. Their father still didn't believe them. They thought that they were the ones who written that on the wall. Brian thought that they were doing this for attention, and he decided that the girls should start seeing a therapist. 2 weeks goes by, the tapping stops, but Daniel would not be done terrorizing the family. January 1987, the girls were home alone when the tapping started again. It was coming from Annie's bedroom. Annie picked up a kitchen knife again, and together two of the girls made their way up the stairs. When they reached the doorway to Annie's bedroom, they saw another message written on the wall. It said, "I'm back. Find me if you can." They ran to their neighbor's home again, telling the neighbor that they found writing on the wall again in their home. They called their father on the phone. Annie and Jessica told him about the tapping again and the writing on the wall. Brian would come home back annoyed. He thought his daughters were making this whole thing up until he realized that there was a new writing on the wall that the girls never told him about over the phone. It read, "Marry me." So now the father knows, like, okay, something fishy is going on here. My daughters aren't doing this on purpose. Finally, this is why it's very important to listen to your children. Yes, kids can lie, but if he didn't believe them at all, even during this point, something bad could have happened to them. So thank God their father believed them this time. Out of the corner of Brian's eye, he sees something moved. He sees a short, scrawny boy standing in the hall. The boy's face was caked with makeup. He was wearing a blonde wig and a dress and had a hatchet in his hand. Brian struggled with the boy and the boy got away. The police were called. When they arrived, they searched through the Andrews home. Behind a chest of drawers or closet in Annie's room, the police found a small door. When they opened it, they found a crawl space there. Inside of it, it was a boy who had attacked Brian. It was Daniel. Brian and Annie both recognized him. Daniel has been living in their wall for about 2 months. They found a sleeping bag, beer cans, and food wrappers in the crawl space. They even found clothes that disappeared from the house. He was arrested immediately. I would literally piss on myself if I knew a boy was living in my walls, moving furniture around, and stealing my food. I would lose my mind. That's extremely creepy. I can't believe that he was literally living inside of their walls. He was 16 at the time, so he was placed in a juvenile detention facility where he spent 10 months from January to October 1987. He turned 17 on May 16, 1987. In October of 1987, Daniel's case was transferred from juvenile court to adult court. Since he was being charged as an adult, he could post bail. His mother helped him with the bail. Instead of her getting her son actual help, she just decides, hey, I'm going to bail him out. He was then free to leave the juvenile detention facility where he would live with his mother. Daniel was charged with 4 counts of kidnapping, 4 counts of armed assault in a dwelling, breaking and entering a dwelling, larceny of more than $100, and malicious destruction of property. On December 11th, 1987, he was due to appear at the Middlesex Superior Court. This doesn't happen. Instead, Daniel commits another crime. In November, he broke into a neighbor's home. He entered the home and stole 2 handguns. On the afternoon of December 1st, 1987, Daniel walked the half mile from his home to the Gustafsson's family's home, which had recently been decorated for Christmas. He was carrying the stolen gun. The Gustafsson family, 33-year-old Priscilla, her husband, 34-year-old Andrew, and their 2 children, 7-year-old Abigail and 5-year-old William. Priscilla was pregnant with her 3rd child. Priscilla was described as sweet and caring. She was a church nursery school teacher. She sang in her church choir and was dedicated to her Christian faith. Daniel went to the Gustafsson home to find Priscilla and William. Abigail took the bus back from school each day and walked a short distance home. Andrew, who was an attorney, was at work. Daniel went after Priscilla first and somehow persuaded her to go into her bedroom, where he would beat and rape her. He put a pillow over her head and shot through it twice. He then drowned William in the bathtub upstairs. When Abigail returned home from school, he drowned her in the bathtub downstairs. When Andrew arrives home from work around 5 p.m., he noticed the house was too quiet. He went upstairs to greet his wife, but unfortunately, he found his wife dead in her room. Priscilla was laying face down on the bed with a pillow over her head. Andrew ran out of the house and called police. When the police arrived, arrived, they discovered the bodies of William and Abigail in a separate bathroom. In the master bedroom, they found two 22 caliber bullet casings, an open untouched can of beer, and semen stains on the bed. They also discovered shoe prints in the flower bed outside the home. Police immediately started to look for the prime suspect on this case. Detectives came up with a list of possible suspects, Daniel being on that list. There were also some items that were taken from the Gustavsson, including a cable television box and a cordless phone. Daniel was known for robberies in the area. He was living with his mother and stepfather at the time, less than a mile from the Gustavsson's home. When you think about it, he committed this crime not too far from his home. So it got me thinking, like, did he want to get caught? Why commit these murders close to where police are able to find out who you are? And also, he left a lot of evidence at the crime scene. What do you guys think about that? The following day, December 2nd, police questioned Daniel, finding him at a Townsend public library. He lied and said he had nothing to do with the murders. He told police he had been at home watching TV most of the day and then attended his 6-year-old niece's birthday party. Police didn't have enough evidence to arrest Daniel. Later the same day, police went to Daniel's home to question him more. He ran into the woods. When they searched the home, they found pieces of evidence, a shirt belonging to Daniel and a wet pair of gloves, which detectives believed he had been wearing when he drowned Abigail and William. They started to search for Daniel. A state police helicopter was used and police dogs, along with 50 local state officers. While on the run, Daniel wasn't good at keeping himself under the radar. Of course, he abducted a woman at gunpoint, making her drive him around town in her Volkswagen van. The woman managed to escape. She called the police to report and that Daniel was driving around in her van. Other people also reported seeing Daniel to the police. Police were able to spot Daniel around 6:30 p.m. on December 3rd. He was hiding in a dumpster at a lumber yard in Ayer, Massachusetts, about 11 miles southeast of Townsend. Daniel was arrested. While arrested, Daniel would start to laugh hysterically, which police officers would find this to be crazy. How can you just laugh hysterically after committing all of these crimes? They even found a gun stuffed in his underwear. He was charged with the murders of Priscilla, Abigail, and William Gustavsson, and was charged with other related crimes he had committed while on a run from the police. These were on top of the charges for his crimes against the Andrews family. Now we're going to be talking about the evidence that police found. They found a 22 caliber bullet casing. It was found at his home, which matched the two found in the Gustavsson's home. The gun used to shoot Priscilla was found by Daniel's stepfather in the glove compartment of a junk Jeep Cherokee, which sat in the yard of their home. A pair of Converse sneakers matched the prints in the flower bed at the Gustavsson's home. They were found in Daniel's closet. A sock with saliva on it was found. Police believe that the sock was used to gag Priscilla Gustavsson. There was other things found, like a necktie, socks, stockings, pantyhose. One of Danny's socks was found to have fibers which matched fibers at the Gustavsson's home. They also found a strand of hair belonging to Abigail on the sock. They found the cordless phone that had been stolen from the Gustavsson's. A thumbprint which belonged to Daniel was identified on the phone. They were able to match Daniel's blood with his semen, the semen stain that they found on Priscilla's bed. At the trial, a K-9 officer testified that his scent the dog picked up from an object in the Gustavsson's home. The dog followed the scent straight through the half mile of the woods where Daniel lived. His trial began in October of 1988, by which the time he was 18 years old. He was ordered to get an evaluation by a psychiatrist. He was found to be fit to stand trial. Even though Daniel was a minor at the time of the murders, the judge had already ruled that he would be tried as an adult. During the trial, the prosecution called as many as 50 witnesses. Many of them were Daniel's own family members. Daniel's attitude during the whole trial was not good. He was smirking and smiling, and he didn't show any remorse for his crimes at the trial. Very unlikable person. The defense did not exactly have an easy time defending Daniel either. His lawyer attempted to argue that the evidence found at his home was circumstantial and could be linked to another member of the family. However, Daniel's brothers and stepfather, they were like, no, he did this. They had nothing to do with the murders. Daniel's lawyer started talking about his bad childhood. You know, he was abused sexually, psychologically by different adults. They tried to do the whole sympathy thing, like, oh, he was abused, so this is why he did what he did type of thing. Daniel was found guilty of all counts After about 5 hours of deliberation by the jury, the judge sentenced him to 3 life sentences to be served consecutively. He is currently incarcerated at the MCI Norfolk Prison in Norfolk, Massachusetts. Family members of the Gustafsons in the public were relieved by the sentence. You know, it's a good thing that Daniel will never be able to walk into the streets again. We don't need nobody like that to be in the streets harming other people. He was a monster. How could you kill a woman that was pregnant with her third child? Like, yes, you're a monster for doing that. Again, Daniel didn't have any remorse for what he has done. He didn't feel anything. There was no guilt. He didn't feel guilty. He didn't feel bad at all. He was just laughing. He thought the whole thing was funny. In 1993, Daniel appealed his conviction. His appeal was denied. Daniel has not exactly been an easy prisoner to handle. You know, he gave everybody a hard time. Daniel was resentenced to his original sentence, 3 life sentences to be served consecutively. He would have the opportunity for parole after 45 years in 2032. Yeah, the court judge was like, nope, this is your sentence. You did these horrific crimes. That's it. Andrew Gustafsson, the only survivor, remarried in 1989 to a woman named Carol Gustafsson, who was also a widow. When Andrew and Carol married, they each wore 2 wedding rings, one to mark their marriage and the other to remember their deceased spouses. The couple had 2 daughters, Holly and Laura. Andrew left his law practice and began working for the state as a child advocate. He stayed in this position for 12 years, then went to work for the Massachusetts Conference of the United Church of Christ. Andrew told the interviewer that he did not think about Daniel often and did not know if he could ever forgive him. As far as I've come, I don't think I've come far enough to deal with that. I've still got more miles to go in my journey. In May 2014, Andrew Gustafsson died of cancer. He was 60 years old. And that is it for this week's Never Too Much True Crime. Daniel was unhinged. He had issues. He came from an abusive background and he's a monster. I'm so glad that he's locked up. My condolences goes to Andrew and his family. I hope Andrew is resting in peace. Thank you guys for listening to me for this Never Too Much True Crime case. I hope to see you guys next week with a new Never Too Much True Crime story. And bye, guys.